a second run up on the Make Strong exercise with a different voice leading at this time, namely Heather. But it really is developing, as I said, in many ways. One of the inadvertent misrepresentations in Joseph Aziz's book is that it makes the exercises feel like they were a collection of sheet music or something, and you just go to one and pull it out. There they come. Don't tell me you ran all the way up here.
I didn't run this time.
Good. Good. We don't have to smell you then. But in point of fact, the exercises were very, very spontaneous by and large, given not even necessarily to groups of people, but to single people who would ask questions, or Rajiv as a teacher would see how they were stuck and improvise a exercise on the spot that would address their specific circumstances. The atmosphere exercise seems to have begun that way, with a woman who was really finding it hard to stay present to her her better nature. But the other thing about them, so the idea that there's a curriculum of exercises that you need to chomp your way through is a misimpression. And the second misimpression is, exercises are not one a day in terms of, well, we do this one, then we do this one, then we do this one. The general pattern was an exercise would be given to an individual or a group, and then they would work for it, in some cases for months, in order to plumb its depths. So the idea that you can go through an exercise in an hour, knock it off, and know that one, is a vast misrepresentation. And that's what we're going to be dealing with. So I think it's pretty clear that there's a few exercises in the bunch that keep finding their way back, and that we're going to be using them more and more during the week. And the Make Strong is one of these, for a couple of reasons, one of which is because it really... Yeah. It really kind of... reinforces yet again this what it means to do things with all three centers, which is the crucial difference. And Aziz was quite right in his book in really pulling this off as almost the most distinctive and unique feature of the Gurdjieffian system of transformation. So it will pull us into that again. It also, you'll see, has it alludes very specifically to the drawing energy from the higher planetary sources. And we're going to be talking, when I talk about air this afternoon, we'll be revisiting that. So the one thing that's very well loved and rather unique about the Make Strong exercise is that it sort of comes in Gurdjieff's own words, and people love it for that. A student transcribed it almost as it sounded as he gave it. And so it picks up this sort of signature broken English that he used. A lot of people said he could probably speak English flawlessly, but when he spoke it in his singular way, it forced people to pay attention in a certain way. So they copied it down, and as it's read, people love to read the whole thing first because you hear Gurdjieff's cadence and expression and way of making connections in it. And so it's well loved. This particular exercise wound up in the New York Public Library in the Jean Tuber collection, I believe. So it wasn't one of the ones that Aziz had to sort of raid from a foundation group where it had been carefully sequestered. It's in the public domain. And as a matter of fact, the folks at Claymont seem to have gotten onto it before anybody else. And Deborah Rose Longo, the music teacher, the movements teacher there, was already working with Make Strong. I remember her introducing a group I was leading to that like 4 years ago. So Heather has worked intensively with her on it, as has Bob. And we thought today that it might be good to let Heather take the helm for a while and share the transmission from Deborah in your own understanding of it. So over to you, my dear.
So as Cynthia said, I first experienced this with Deborah in 2016 and have been working with it. And it is a very profound exercise. And I'm going to read the note that Cynthia is referring to here before we begin. So this is the note that was written down in 1939. 15-minute body relaxation. Break tempo of ordinary life before doing exercise. Breathe in I, breathe out am. With all three parts do, not just mind, feeling and body also. Make strong, not easy thing.
Can you read just a little slower?
Sure.
Thanks.
When you breathe out, imagine part of the air staying in and flowing everywhere inside. Where flow, how flow. That is its business. Only feel that part remains, saying internally, I wish to keep this substance for myself. Without this conscious and voluntary labor on your part, nothing at all will be coded. All will in time evaporate. To be able to do exercise not lopsidedly, you must put whole attention on it. To arouse feeling, interest, and attention, for cooperation, you must think the following before beginning. I am now about to begin this exercise. With full attention, I will draw in my breath, saying I, and sensing the whole of myself. I wish very much to do this in order that I may digest air. To arouse body to cooperate, take corresponding posture, inner tension of forces. Mobilize your centers for working together for this aim. In breathing, imagine something flows, like when inhaling cigarette. Breathing in I, put the attention on the center of the chest, a feeling, a connection to that which is sacred within us, or a yearning for the connection. Breathe out am, sensing the whole of your body. Sensing and feeling can blend together. So now I invite you just to close your eyes or have them cast down. And becoming aware of the natural flow of your breath. And assuming a posture that you can hold for about 20 minutes, 25 minutes. Checking your vertical alignment, making sure your spine has the support that it needs to remain upright. Just following the natural flow of your breath and noticing a sensation of your vertical alignment. So you're aware of both. And the flow of your breath and sensing your vertical alignment. And the first section of this exercise is the relaxation part. And as you continue to be aware of the natural flow of your breath and your vertical alignment, we're going to move through the body, and as I name each part, allowing that part to relax. Or you can even see the part, find the part that's at ease there and let it grow. Let it take up more space with each breath, moving finer and finer in from the skin down through the muscle to the bone. Allowing your attention to sink in deeper, and the ease, the spaciousness, the relaxation to take up more space. So we'll begin with the top of the head. With each breath, inviting more ease, relaxation in that part. Forehead, and the eyes and eyebrows. Cheeks, and the mouth, the lips, the tongue, the gums. Jaw, with each breath, inviting more relaxation, sensing further from the surface of the skin down through the tissue. Ears, and of the head. When the mind wanders, just bring it back gently without any judgment or tension entering in. And then neck. Shoulders, finding the places of ease there and letting them grow. Chest and upper back. Upper arms. Lower arms and wrists and hands. Sensing finer and finer as you relax. The abdominal area, and lower back. Pelvic area and hips, upper legs, and lower legs, and calves and shins. Ankles and feet. Gentle gratitude for the body. Now bring your attention to the bottom of the feet. This is called the filling. With our attention, we're going to come back up the body from the bottom of our feet and sense the arising of the sensation you've established by relaxing. You can now be strengthened by sensing this filling up from the bottom of the feet, like water filling a vessel. We're sensing the presence in sensation, that quality of aliveness rising up through the feet, the ankles. The lower legs into the knees. Through the thighs, through the hands and lower arms, through the pelvic area and hips, rising that aliveness, into the abdominal area, rising through the upper body, the back and upper arms, to the shoulders, the neck, into the head, the top of the head. Remembering to be aware of the natural flow of your breathing and sensing your vertical alignment. Now fully sensing the body and the surface of the skin, the whole body, through the tissues to the bone. Now bringing your attention to when you inhale. And as you inhale at your natural flow, allow your attention to be in the center of your chest. Just being here, sensing the presence of your chest area. And when you exhale, following the natural flow of your breath, bringing your awareness to the full sensation of the whole body, or at least the limbs, the arms and legs. So you're breathing in with an awareness of the tension in the center of your chest, breathing out an awareness of the whole body, especially the arms and legs. Expanding your attention to become aware of the group. That group that makes these days possible, and to the unseen in the room. See if you can access the feeling of gratitude as you breathe in with attention in the center of your chest. And when you breathe out, coming back to the awareness of your body, especially the arms and legs. You're breathing in with a feeling of gratitude, sensing the center of your chest, breathing out an awareness of the whole body. Is making the distinction between feeling as you breathe in that gratitude and sensing as you're aware of the body. Leave that part still with the attention on the natural flow of the breath and the sensation of the vertical alignment, with the attention in the chest on the in-breath and the body on the out-breath. And this time when we breathe in, we say inwardly, I. The I that represents that part of us that's connected to the sacred, to the whole, to the divine mystery. Or at least a wish to be connected to it if you don't feel a feeling of the connection. And then when you exhale, you say, am inwardly, sensing your body here again. Breathing in, I, feeling that connection, breathing out, am, aware of the body and sensation. Again, your mind is making the distinction between sensing and feeling. Feeling the I, sensing am. And this last part of the exercise is to be done if you've been able to make the distinction between sensing and feeling. Gurdjieff said this is not an easy thing. He says all three parts must do. This is about the finer energies in the air. If you can do this exercise with all three parts, it's about the finer energies in the air. And we can, with our attention, begin to breathe in the finer energies. And when you breathe out, some of them remain and go where they need to go. Now, with your awareness on the natural flow of your breath, your vertical alignment, breathing in the finer energies, allowing some to remain on the exhale and go where they need to go. And you can let the exercise go. Slowly opening your eyes and letting them make their way around the room. And when you're ready, will stand for the three bows, the three rakus. The first bow in honor of our individual work on ourselves. The second bow in honor of the work of the group. And the third bow in honor of the great work, the mystery, the divine, of things we don't know.
Wonderful refrain from that exercise, which seems to carry over and sing itself in life. Make strong, not an easy thing. And it's one of these phrases that you can go on. What is make strong? And you kind of sense your way into that. Technically, to do it with all the pieces engaged in all three centers, sensing, feeling, remembering to in-breathe on the I beginning and out-breathe, shifting the center of attention as you do it, keeping your attention from wandering, being aware of breathing in those higher substances, being substances, breathing out, keeping yourself collected in the midst of all this multiple demand. So to make strong is, in a sense, to really do it with as much of yourself present as possible. And that's been a refrain I've taken out into life, make strong. And not an easy thing. Not an easy thing to do any part of this exercise. It requires you, as all exercises do, to meet it with your voluntary attention, with your conscious labor. That if you float to see whether it's entertaining, it won't be. You know? That there's something we have to bring to a demand in life. Showing up is part of it, but what you do after you show up is the rest of it. So the exercise has got some powerful refrains. I'm going to talk some more this afternoon. I'm going to pick up on the thread of air and try to tie together some of what I've made a first pass over this week, along with looking a little bit at some of the universal practices that have worked with air in a healing and cleansing kind of way, and then look at a little bit at the specificities of what seems to be evolving for our plate too. So that will be some of the afternoon, as well as my own comments on, you know, Eva's sharing last night, and which will serve as just sort of a frame for that second part. But we have a little bit of time at this point, just a little bit before we would need to break for lunch. And if anybody has any questions, comments, or reflections from some of the morning's work or anything else, we can take a few minutes to get that launched. Yes, Eileen.
I just want to say that when Heather directed us to look around the room, my eyes went on that piece of artwork, which I didn't really consciously see, but what I heard in my spirit was anchored in Christ, united together. And then I looked and are they anchors of some sort?
Yes, no doubt.
They are.
It is Stonington. Yes.
The point was, I didn't realize until I looked at them that that's what they were.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. And of course, the anchor is the great symbol in Christian symbology of hope. Cool. Bree.
I've been trying to weave, you know, taking the thread of what you're offering from this Gurdjieff Teilhard flow and weaving it into some of the work that I've been doing over the last 6 months, and in particular, randomly studying studying self-compassion within Buddhism and the lineage, the Japanese lineages of Buddhism that teach heartfulness, mm-hmm. which is not how mindfulness has been imported and turned into its own thing,
mm-hmm.
but rather the three centered presence anchored in the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they bring forward, it's almost painful, I was sharing this with Rebecca, it's almost painful that Buddhism teaches incarnation and incarnational love better than we do.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that they teach and some of the new research that's emerging, particularly under the work of Dr. Kirsten Nerf, is around the quality of attention. It's not just that we pay attention,
mm-hmm.
but it's how we pay attention. What is the nature of the light that we're shining in our presence?
Mm-hmm.
And you may be going in this direction, so if this is for later,
mm-hmm.
but it seems to me that this is the Christic illuminating, that's the opportunity of the Christic to illuminate and infuse our presence with a particular quality of love.
Yeah.
That sometimes, and I think we're all prone to do this, particularly in this group, we get really hooked on one map or one system, but all these maps are pointing to the same thing. But it's uniquely our opportunity to bring forth that Christic, loving, compassionate, heartbroken energy that infuses a completely different kind of presence into this world,
mm-hmm.
that is creative, that is kenotic, that's what makes Bob's movements not just, mm-hmm. but the quality with which you bring forward your broken-hearted, Christic human experience that then makes it so sacred. And I don't know where I'm going with my question, except to say I can feel that Christic invitation,
mm-hmm.
uniquely calling us in this moment,
mm-hmm.
to be humble about our maps and to pay more attention to our how,
mm-hmm.
and what that energy is of how we do what we do. And is that somewhere this transaction of reciprocal breathing? I guess I'm asking if the 12 to the 24 to the 48, are they not just deeply nested in each other? And is it not love that bears it out?
They're deeply nested in each other, yes. And everything is in everything else. And that to string things out on a barbecue skewer, as it's traditionally been presented in, you know, symbologies, is just a shorthand of representation, like taking the whole planet, the whole world, and putting it in a Mercator projection.
Mm-hmm.
So really, the maps come closer that are the ones that are being generated, the fractal maps that can work in 11 dimensions, really come closer to portraying it. But so many, many layers to your comments and questions. One, of course, is that the maps are only the outer layer,
yeah.
of something that goes in, and it's never either or. That the Buddhists speak profoundly about having a right view, and the idea is to give the minimum amount of framework necessary in order to allow a view not to be simplistic, to allow, to admit it, to open up deeper levels of complexity when you're ready for it, but not to get people so lost in the intricacies of it from the start that they can't move through. And that's been one of the ongoing kind of shadow sides of the Gurdjieff work, that because for certain reasons, which I think also belong to your question, the intellectual center met the work front and forward, and people start reading groups and thinking groups, and that it tends to lend itself very easily to be taken over by nerds. And there was a whole school that basically came out of the British work where they didn't do movements at all. Mm-hmm. Movements was always the heart and soul and integrating thing, but the Uspensky line never really took to it. Mm-hmm. And so the way the work kind of formulated itself in the United States when it got started was these kind of semi-secretive groups that spent 2 or 3 years sort of pondering these intricate mathematical maps. And so people get the feeling that it's dry, it's cerebral, it's all that kind of stuff. And it's only when you move through that gate and in the movements and the prayers and the exercises that you begin to see the kind of physical technology it's based on. The Buddhists have always been great in not spending almost any time whatsoever on the theory and cutting right to the practice, although it means that sometimes the theory gets woefully misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And we get Buddhism light, which is what we've got a lot today.
Yeah.
The other thing that you talk about, qualities of attention, generating the Christic love, the big thing that it's taken me years to unpack in Gurdjieff, and as I go in deeper and deeper, it moves me more and more, is the depth of his actual Christic love, you know, that his Christic love for God. Mm-hmm. He was not a particular lover of Christ, but through Christ he was a deep lover of God. But he was very, very clear that people in their usual sense, in their usual way, that would bring too coarse an energy and an energy too identified with their personal egoic self. So that this love that they authentically felt would very quickly kind of devolve into sentimentality and manipulation. And that's tended to be the shadow side of Christianity. Mm-hmm. You talk about love and everybody's great, brain goes fuzzy. You know, you just need to create a firmer container. And this agapeic, Christic love is so fine and depends on such a fine quality of attention to really transmit that to think you can hear, for example, praise music and get from that to the Christic love, it ain't going to work. It requires a sustained subtilization of the being. And the Buddhists do that very well. And Gurdjieff works very well on increasing subtleties of attention. But what tended to happen in the work is that this got picked up by people that had a much more transpersonal kind of investment into it. They were all Krishnamurti people.
Yeah.
So they got interested in attention as an energy itself and lost the understanding of its connection to the heart of divine love. It's like, well, let's just pay attention in this very fine way, and then we can draw down these finer energies. It's almost like, you know, some sort of elite voodoo.
Yeah.
And because when you lose the heart, I think myself that we cannot generate Christic love.
Mm-hmm.
And when we start talking tomorrow and more seriously about how do we address this woeful lack in paschal courage, my sense is that we can't sit down there and sort of vision or represent or conjure it up. That the only way to do it is to connect with World 12 and then mediate it.
Mm.
And that's the real goal.
Mm. it feels as if there's a thread there about your teachings in Mary Magdalene,
mm-hmm.
and the wisdom of Jesus. It's the brokenhearted.
Mm-hmm.
It's the longing that can't be
yep.
fulfilled. There's a quality to that tension.
Yep.
That once accepted,
exactly.
then can yield it, manifest it.
Yep.
That's part of what I was trying to say poorly about what was so beautiful, Bob, about what you
yep.
represented yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a quality to it, and you can tell when people are speaking out of it. But the kicker is that it usually comes out of great suffering. You know. And the ones that have been, you know, that it gets generated, frankly, by having your heart broken
yeah.
into little pieces and not giving in to disillusionment or despair. And in that sense, it's always in the service of the species. Because it's no fun to have your heart broken into little bits and pieces. And until it can be poured out into the broken heart of the planet, Eucharistically, it really, you know, you just look like a ticket for poor mental health. So the ability to toughen and to the point where you can bear the beams of love is part of it. And I think that the original brilliant genius of Christianity was to draw people consistently toward that edge so that more and more the stuff of their life could allow them to stand in the face of great pain, great heartbreak, great suffering. And rather than it making them hard and bitter, it made them totally soft and Eucharistic in terms of that from their one body broken for the world, great harmony comes. It's very interesting to consider particularly the second half of Teilhard's life from this perspective. And that he took his vows very seriously, and he had at least a couple of real occasions on his plate with meeting great love, meeting, you know, marital love and spousal love in the deepest way, and always pushing it away. And it was sort of so strange in a way, and so completely, you know, obdurate and stubborn and self, you know, not even good common sense in a way, because the church had basically shafted him anyway. He had a small but adoring and trusting public in the university system. And if he had just said, to hell with you bastards, gotten married, accepted the position that was offered him at the Sorbonne or any of a half a dozen other places to teach, he would have had his voice, he would have had his support system, he would have, you know, everything he wanted. It would have worked way, way, way better in terms of the logic of 48. And for him to hold stubbornly to this vow of celibacy, which in many ways he totally seen through. But, and in the face of a church that was just, you know, they get him down and kicked him, and it didn't result in his life in a sort of integrated happiness. That he spent a lot of the last 4 years of his life in anguish, 6 years of his life in anguish, on the edge of nervous collapse, major heart attack, you know, but sort of percolating through this kind of mess that any good psychotherapist could have helped him disentangle, there was these moments of complete radiance where he talks about, you know, actually living in God all the time. and being able to say, since in all the ways of my life from the beginning I have sought you, O Christ, I know that when the doors of my life close, there I will be with you. I mean, there was a, it's almost like on another wavelength, this whole Eucharistic healing, like the healing of his heart happened in World 12. And kind of downloaded down, and the heart remained broken in all the lower worlds.
I'm having the same, the felt sense I did when you were talking about Babette's Feast.
Yeah. So, as they say, c'est compliqué.
Oui.
But you're asking the right questions. Yeah. Good. Anything else before we break for lunch? Yeah, Bob?
This idea of alchemy and transforming energy. This afternoon, do you have room to say a little bit more about it? Like a recent example, it's a simple one, is, you know, a messy basement, needing to clean it out, tools all scattered, not wanting to do it, you know, but last week, it was kind of like willing to do what I just didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in my head, but a part of me came to a place of liking what I disliked or being willing to do something that I was just not wanting to do. And the what could have been a bad day turned it, it was like an infusion of energy that came from flipping something inside of me in a real way, not in a fake way.
Yeah.
Or, you know, getting tired of computer work, not liking to be so much in front of the computer. And if I go into the day that way, by the end of it, I'm a mess full of just drained energy.
Yeah.
But if this little switch can go from not wanting to want or dislike to like, it changes the whole energy equation. And so at the end of the day, I'm not, you know, there's an infusion, real infusion of energy that happens from a little, it feels like it's a little switch that you can flip one way or the other.
Yep, right. That's the whole conscious work, conscious labor part of it, that as you're able to it, and intentional suffering, as you intentionally use your freedom to take it off of the like-dislike scale and begin to approach it from a different angle, already you're freeing up energy.
Yeah.
That I remember how things flipped for me big time when I was working in the work in our little work group in Halifax one year. We were in Toronto, and we just bought this farm, and we had 150 people coming to the work group thing, and it had two toilets. So they quickly created a task force to build a whole bunch more toilets, and then they had a toilet cleaning team. So guess which one, you know, I was on the outhouse team. And we were there, and you know, we had to tramp around and clean them out every day. Not, you know, and I remember our team leader was also the movement's pianist and one of the elders in the work. There's this fiery little woman named Elsa Densey, and she told us one day as we were starting this with our little buckets of lye and our dreadfully dour looks on our face. She says, cleaning is about creating impressions. And impressions are the third and most powerful being food. And she says that as you bring something to order, you're it's actually the result to play and to make art at a higher level of coherence. And that completely whipped around for me the whole aspect of my, for me, cleaning had been something that my mother had to do because my father didn't make enough money to hire servants. So, you know, through those various veils of bad attitudes, I never learned to clean well. And then when she taught us the next day that trick, she says, And if you want your work to be maximally effective, learn to put your attention where the two work surfaces meet. And she showed us how when you're scrubbing, for example, when you're scrubbing a mat that you've spilled a cup of coffee on, that the two work surfaces are meeting where the sponge or whatever you're using is going against the carpet. You know, it's where first and second force are meeting. And if you use your attention, if you place your attention right there, and one of the things that's interesting about all these exercises is they're teaching you how to place attention at a place, a preliminary skill to learning how to alter its quality, that you create a sort of third force alchemy there, and you get a wildly different result. And so armed with these tools of creating impressions and learning that every interface between zones and work is a potential for third force to enter through your attention and radically create a different outcome, work cleaning has become a real invitation to develop better control over my attention as well as my like and dislike. And it does release energy. Any energy that is not siphoned off to cement still further the story of yourself is available to you to live the real story of yourself at a higher level. The single biggest energy leak that keeps human beings floating just below the Mi-Fa gateway is the insistence on maintaining your egoic meta-narrative. If you could just get over it, you would have so much energy at your disposal for any kind of transformation. And no, Virginia, I'm not talking about spiritual bypass it. I'm talking about the release of a huge megadosh of stuck energy that you don't really need, because that thing that you spend so much of your life maintaining, improving, you know, consummating, confessing about, praying for, is a transient piece of your identity anyway. You know, it's the tool you use to get around in this world, to mediate. You need to keep it in good shape. But to think it's you is psychosis. You know, it's not you, but it's not you. And so as you begin to learn to systematically inventory and release all that potential soul energy and healing energy and life energy that's stuck in the old narrative of yourself, and boom, you've got it, and you get a shot in the arm. Exactly. So you learned a lot, and the basement got cleaner. And Heather's got a place to stay if she moves to Shepherd's now. Not underneath your hammers. Okay, so this afternoon, a quick rundown. We're back at 2:30. That Heather's gonna. We'll start with movements again, and we're gonna really work with the for profits. I think to see if we can get the other two. We got the Thurible Swinging Jesus and the Tapping Mohammed. What will Buddha and Lama give us? But this is not only beautiful work in its own sense. But it's going to tie in, because I want to work with the four ideals exercise. And four prophets, four ideals are variant ways of naming the same body of teaching. And so the time we spend actually working with this as a movement and as a gesture this afternoon will pave the way for the work we do tomorrow. And I'll think more about where we go this afternoon, whether we constitute a web again or whether we do something else. I've still got 2 hours to take a pulse of the group and see what wants to happen. And Andrew's flexible, right? We'll see where it wants to go. Then I'm gonna teach on, you know, air, basically. And then we go to dinner. So that's the that's the shape of the day. So have yourselves a tidy little lunch. Settle up with Mary Ellen if you haven't for the cost of the dinner. Or have we got everybody?
Oh,
we
got a few.
We got a, okay, she's going to go hunting for you.
And,
sorry.
Yeah, okay. And we will see you back here at 2:30. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Exactly, and that's not what she said. She said use it. Buddy said Dr. Downs is all over her ribs. And tea tree oil spray is all over her. So the not, that the not, don't use it. We all heard that.
Okay.
So I'm sitting here thinking, no, wait a second. No, she said Dr. Downs is all over her.
So it was just using a natural soap.
It's using a natural
soap. What happened? Didn't she say her?
I think we missed it.